This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
And this is Beth Silvers. Thank you for joining us for Pantsuit Politics. It's Beth, and I am so glad you're here with us today. I am thrilled to be sharing a conversation with McKay Coppins with you. McKay is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the New York Times bestselling author of Romney, A Reckoning. You know that I have been obsessed with this book since I read it back in October, and I loved this conversation. Before we jump into it, let me remind you that if you're still working on your holiday gifting, we can help. We have lots of fun Pantsuit Politics merchandise on our website. You can grab something for yourself or the friend that you always text with about the episodes. You can get some best holiday available to you wrapping paper to ensure the whole holiday has a little Pantsuit Politics flair to it. If you use the wrapping paper, please tag us on social media and show us. We would love to see it. Be a present to us. Okay, McKay Coppins' book has been everywhere this fall, and it has been on my mind for a ton of reasons. Mostly, I think, because it's a book about soul searching. The longer Sarah and I make Pantsuit Politics, the more I would describe it as a podcast about political soul searching. Sarah and I are trying to practice all week, every week. How can we test our beliefs? How can we challenge our assumptions? How can we ask what we've rationalized in the past and how we feel about that rationalization? Can we try to see more clearly what we might be rationalizing today? But that process is different for every person, and the stakes are different for every person. So Mitt Romney's soul-searching process has taken place in a very high-stakes way for him, for his family, for the country. I wanted to talk with McKay about Mitt Romney, not because I think he's a hero or a villain. I loved this book because it showed the senator, for all of his success and notoriety and wealth, as just a person who holds grudges, watches TV, puts salmon on hamburger buns with ketchup, loves his wife, worries about what people think of him. He is also a person who's recently engaged in a deep examination of what has motivated his decisions. At poignant moments, Mitt Romney has asked, "Are my actions consistent with others' expectations of me or with my expectations for myself?" He's passed and failed his own assessments in varying degrees. I think any of us engaged in an honest reckoning about ourselves would come to that conclusion. And I think this reckoning has been informative, but not necessarily transformative for Mitt Romney. Just this week, he's tweeted about clueless Dems. He said he doesn't attach great importance to everything Donald Trump has said in response to questions about Trump's comments that he would be a dictator on day one of his presidency, but not after. I find all of that kind of relatable, that Mitt Romney has this deep disappointment in his party. He's personally hurt. He's professionally incredulous. But he is in so many ways the same man who was the Republican nominee for president not too long ago. I like Mitt Romney. I do not idolize him. And that's why I think McKay's book provides such a compelling case study in personal stock taking. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation as much as I did.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit. So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June mani system at home, because we can all get a good looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon grade tools that are so easily explained, so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first mani system. Coppins, thank you so much for coming to Pantsuit Politics.
Thanks for having me on.
You wrote my favorite book of the year by far.
That's so nice. Thank you.
I think it really met me where I am in a lot of ways, because I was a Republican, registered Republican until 2019. I just changed my registration to be Republican again so that I could vote against Donald Trump in the upcoming primary. I just have this ongoing struggle with where I fit in today's political scene. I also recognize a lot of the less flattering parts of myself in Mitt Romney. So I loved this book. I know that you've talked about it a lot. Since we're talking near the end of the year, when a lot of us are doing stock takes anyway, I wanted to go through what I saw as the themes of the book that allowed Mitt Romney to do this therapeutic process with you that he went through. So I wondered if we could talk about what we can all learn from those themes. It seems to start to me with a precipitating event. And I keep asking myself if January 6th was that for Mitt Romney, or if that is a little too simplistic.
No, I think that's fair. I think that he might have already been doing some reflection kind of privately, but I think that January 6th and everything that happened to him personally, you know, himself kind of narrowly escaping this mob that had broken into the Capitol, and kind of what he felt it meant about the country and kind of the fragile state of democracy in America, all of that led him to be willing to kind of be vulnerable in public, or at least to start in front of me as a biographer, right? It's interesting because I approached him about doing this book right after January 6th. I think it was the first text message I sent about it was literally like a couple days later. And then a few weeks later was our first conversation. I remember there were still barbed wire fencing around the Capitol when we had our first meeting about it. And it really did seem like something had sort of shaken loose in him after January 6th. And I think it does sometimes take like a really dramatic, almost traumatic event to cause us to sort of take stock. And he was very clearly to me asking himself difficult questions about, you know, the state of his party, the state of the country. And he was sort of ready in an interesting way to look back on his own life and career and take stock of where he had made mistakes and where he had compromised on his principles and in the name of ambition or career or partisan tribalism. And as a writer, that made him such an interesting subject, because it is very rare. I can say this as somebody who's profiled a lot of politicians for magazines, and it is very rare to have them in that kind of vulnerable place. So I do think January 6th was sort of a catalyzing moment for him.
Did that catalyzing moment have to come back around in your conversations? It felt as a reader Like, you got several versions of Mitt Romney as you spent time with him over the years, because none of us are consistent. And I wonder if there were times when you felt him pulling back a little and you had to sort of remind him of why you were doing this.
I do think that part of my role as his biographer and as a journalist was to sort of remind him of that feeling he had in the days and weeks and months after January 6th. You know, in one of our very first conversations after we started working on the book, and this was still just a few months after January 6th, he showed me this map on the wall of his office. And I kind of opened the book with it. And it's called the Histo Map. And the idea of this map is that it charts the rise and fall of the most powerful civilizations throughout human history. So you look at it and it shows, as it goes along a timeline, the Greeks and the Romans and the Assyrians and the Egyptians. And he showed me this map and he said, you know, the thing that sticks out to me now looking at this map is how rare it is for democracies to thrive. Throughout human history, most of the most powerful civilizations were autocracies of some kind, right? And it's kings and emperors and kaisers and rulers. And it's very rare for a thriving civilization to be based on the idea of self-government and self-rule. And he told me, and again, this is just after January 6th, he told me, I genuinely wonder if we are taking for granted America's commitment to democracy. He actually told me a very large portion of my party really doesn't believe in the Constitution. And that was his revelation after January 6th. But as you mentioned, I spent 2 years interviewing him for this book, and we would meet all the time. It was 45 interviews by the end. And there were times, you know, months, years later, years into this process, where it felt like he was sort of maybe losing sight of that key revelation he had had, because he still had a day job as a senator and he would get pulled back into the morass of, you know, daily partisan politics and legislating and the back and forth between Democrats and Republicans and, you know, some unfair story that was written about him in the press. And these things would become distractions. And there were times where I felt like I had to kind of be like, you know, remember the map on the wall? You know, remember that feeling you had? Do you still worry about that? In fact, I remember one time, it was near Christmas, I think 2021. So this is now about a year after January 6th. I was in his office, his Senate office, late at night. Most of his staff had gone home or gone to Christmas parties. And I was kind of pressing him on this question, because he had decided he wasn't going to join Democrats in voting for a voting rights bill. And he had some, you know, objections to it, some specific policy objections that I thought were reasonable. But I actually read him a snippet from an Atlantic essay that one of my colleagues had written recently, where he kind of critiqued Mitt Romney and said, Romney has moral courage. He's capable of moral courage. But after the immediate crisis of Trump's presidency passed, Romney returned to the narrow thinking of a party man. And I kind of read that to him in part to get a rise out of him a little bit and to needle him, but also in part to sort of remind him, like, you know, you have recognized the kind of potentially fatal weaknesses in American democracy at this moment and in your own party. And I'm wondering if you've lost sight of it, or if you've changed your mind, or if you've evolved. And he actually did, to his credit, when I would do that, kind of he was humble enough to sort of sit back and take stock and reevaluate. He, you know, sometimes he would start off defensive. You know, I wasn't trying to convince him of anything, right? I didn't feel like that was my role as a writer. It was just, I just wanted to kind of see if his mind had changed or his thinking had evolved. And often in the course of that conversation, he would go back to sort of taking stock and say, you know, that might be right. Let me think about it this way. And so he was remarkably vulnerable for a sitting politician. He would become defensive or maybe get a little angry, or, you know, we'd have kind of confrontational conversations, but then he would circle back and start again. And I thought that, again, made him a really compelling subject, but also kind of, I think there's something admirable in that.
That segues really nicely to what I saw as the next ingredient of his reckoning, which is like a sense of duty. That to me speaks to the histo map as a reminder of some of the standards that he feels obligated to uphold as an elected official. Also, though, throughout the book, the references to his dad felt like they created a sense of duty, and also just his talents, like the way he loves to fix a disaster. I wonder how much you saw his sense of obligation pushing him in this process.
There's no question. I mean, the story he tells himself about his family and his heritage and his own identity is built around this term that he uses called the Romney obligation. And he talks about a lot about it in his dad. His dad was the, you know, liberal governor of Michigan. He was an auto executive, ran for president as a liberal Republican in the 1960s. And he said that, you know, my dad always had this tendency to never be comfortable to rest on his laurels, right? Like he had made a fortune running an auto company in Detroit. And, you know, Mitt said, like, my dad could have just, you know, enjoyed his fortune and retired, but he always had this obligation to kind of be anxiously engaged in a good cause. He wanted to be fixing problems and giving of himself in a kind of public-spirited way. And Mitt felt that he inherited that. He, you know, he made his own much larger fortune as a businessman in management consulting and then private equity. But when the Olympics called and the Salt Lake City Olympics were in trouble in the late 90s and he was approached about taking them over to turn it around, it was actually his wife, Anne, who said, your life should be about more than making money. And that really kind of like struck a nerve with him because he knew his dad had been that way, right? His dad's life was about more than making money. In fact, his dad had died not long after Mitt Romney's first Senate bid, his failed Senate bid in Massachusetts. And when he went to the funeral, the thing that stood out to him was that most of the people who were there to mourn him were not talking about his successful business career or his ability to exceed quarterly profit expectations, right? They were there to pay tribute to a public servant. And Mitt felt this compulsion always throughout his life to kind of follow his dad's example, to use his talents to do something. And I write in the book that his defining trait is a meld of moral obligation and personal hubris. And I think that is true, that like sometimes it could manifest in sort of hubristic ways. Like he really believes that he can solve almost any problem if he's kind of given the ability to. But it also can manifest in really kind of, you know, good and admirable ways. And he is somebody who I think part of the reckoning that happened is a product of his desire to leave a positive legacy behind.
That specific flavor of arrogance is something that I see in myself as well. It was a little hard to read, but helpful.
Well, wait, can I ask you about that before you move on?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm just curious. Like, so I don't know if it's a bad thing. Like, it's funny because I was talking to somebody else about this book, and he said the thing that comes through reading this book is that Mitt Romney has a lot of moral vanity. You know, like he thinks of himself as a good person, an important person, and that's very important to his conception of himself. But the argument that this friend was making was like, I actually don't know that we are suffering from a surplus of moral vanity in our politics right now. Like, if anything, we might have like too much amorality, right? Like too much nihilism in our politics. And maybe it's good for us to kind of see ourselves as good people and then hold ourselves to those standards. Like, do you feel like it's a bad thing that you have that brand of arrogance?
I think it's both. You know, it just depends on how I deploy it.
Right.
But I love that you brought this up because Sarah and I were having a conversation about this book and how it is probably the most widely read book in Congress right now. At least I hope it is. And then you see all of these people running for the exits. Just today, we're learning Patrick McHenry, Kevin McCarthy aren't coming back. And I said to her, I hope that what people are taking from this book is not don't try to serve. I don't think that's the lesson of Mitt Romney's life at all.
Not at all. And I had this fear, actually, because in a couple of the early interviews I did about the book, actually, before it was even published, I kind of pre-recorded a couple interviews. And several people kind of told me, you know, reading this book was really demoralizing, like seeing how craven and cynical and hypocritical people are behind the scenes was really dispiriting. And, you know, on one hand, I wanted to reveal that. And I felt like an important part of this book was kind of exposing the depths of cynicism and hypocrisy behind the scenes. But the message was not walk away from politics altogether, like we should all throw our hands up. You know, I think that like the messiness of Mitt Romney's political career, where he had major defeats and major triumphs where he was sometimes the best version of himself and sometimes the worst. Like, that is just the reality of a human-based politics, you know? Like, as long as humans are the ones who are running for office and making decisions, it's going to be messy. But what made Mitt Romney, to the extent that he can be looked at as a positive model for politics, it's that he never walked away, right? He was constantly going back into the fray, right? Like, I mean, after 2012, when he lost his second presidential campaign, he was ready to essentially retire from public life. And he tried. But when Donald Trump ran for president and then won the primary, and then especially after he won the presidency, Romney just felt this compulsion to kind of get back in the game. And he, you know, he wanted to steer the Republican Party away from Trumpism, and he wanted to act as a check on what he considered Trump's more kind of authoritarian impulses. And he wanted to be there to help solve the big issues of the day. And, you know, he easily could have enjoyed his retirement. He's a very wealthy man. He has a great relationship with his wife and kids and grandkids, but he felt this duty to serve. And I think that what I hope people take away from the book is that it is really important to stay in the mix, but that also we should expect our politicians to be good people, right? This is like the one of my hobby horses is that, like, we have all internalized way too much cynicism about politics in the last 10 years to the point where I think it's very common for people on both the left and the right to say, oh, all politicians are bad. They're all snakes. We shouldn't expect, you know, them to be good people. And we should just vote our interests, right? And I just think that's, like, wrong. Like, I think that's fundamentally wrong. I think the story of Mitt Romney is one of a guy who was constantly wrestling with his conscience. And sometimes he did the right thing and sometimes he did the wrong thing. But he had a functioning conscience and he was trying to do what was right. And I think we should expect that from all of our politicians. We should not just throw our hands up and kind of give up on politics altogether.
Yeah, what I took from the book in terms of public service is that if you are going this route and you really feel called to do it, you need a lot of anchors in your life. That Anne was and is essential, that his children were and are essential. I was having a conversation about our Republican Secretary of State in Kentucky, Michael Adams, who has been exceptional. He has been such a good public servant, such a good partner to our Democratic governor, even as they don't always agree. And I was talking about his political future with someone, and I found myself thinking as they were saying, you know, he might run for governor, he might run for Senate. I just kept thinking, I hope that doesn't ruin him. And what a sad instinct on my part.
I know.
And so I guess I just am trying to look at this book and think, you know, what do people need to not be ruined by this process? Because the answer can't be no good people in public service. It has to be more of them just surrounded by more support, and I guess a public that is willing to give them a little bit more grace than we tend to.
I do think we as voters, as constituents, should maybe have slightly more realistic expectations of our political leaders. But I want to talk about the other thing you said, this idea of having anchors in your life. So I write in the epilogue of the book about this kind of really interesting body of research. And I only kind of glance at it, but it's something I want to look at more and hopefully write about more in the future. But there's this interesting body of research that shows that the effect of power on the brain, and what it shows basically is that when we are feeling powerful, when people are feeling powerful, they become less empathetic, more impulsive, less able to mimic other people's experiences. And you can imagine, when people are powerful for a very long time, most of these studies are done with something called power priming, where they basically average people and get them to think about times when they had power in their lives, and then these impulses start to flare up. But now apply that idea to people who are wealthy and powerful for years or even decades, right? What happens is something like brain damage, right? Like, you become, it's very hard to remain a grounded, normal person, an empathetic person, when you have a lot of power. But what experts say, and this shows up a lot in the lives of, you know, great leaders we see, is that the more toeholds you have in your life, the more people in your life who can call you out and keep you grounded and correct you and who have known you for a long time from before you were powerful, the better off you are. And Mitt Romney has, in a lot of ways, kind of built a life around toe holders. He's still married to his high school sweetheart. They have a, you know, very mutually respectful relationship. It's kind of amazing when you read the book how often Anne pops up at kind of crucial moments in his career to give him advice and end up steering him in the direction he would end up going. But he also has, you know, relationships with his sons and his daughters-in-law and his grandkids. I spent a day up at his kind of family compound in New Hampshire on Lake Winnipesaukee one summer during their family reunion. You can just tell that he has put in the time to maintain these relationships. And I think that really matters because, again, I mentioned I've spent a lot of time interviewing, profiling powerful people throughout my career. And a lot of people get to the point that Mitt Romney's at. They're in their 70s. And they've made a lot of money and they've had phenomenally successful careers and they're powerful and famous. And then they look around and they realize that their family life is kind of a disaster. You know, a lot of them are divorced or estranged from their kids or you know, not they don't have great marriages. And I think one of the keys to Mitt Romney's success in life, but also his ability to kind of reckon with his mistakes, is that he has these relationships. He's put the time and care into nurturing these relationships with people who can be frank with him and be honest with him about where he's erring or where he's kind of getting away from himself.
I wonder if that on its own is enough to lead someone down this path of self-reflection, or if a foil is also necessary. Could Mitt Romney have gotten here without Donald Trump?
Yeah, it's a great point. You're actually, I think, the first one who's asked me that question in exactly that way. I mean, this whole conversation has been unique, but I think that is an interesting insight. I think that in some ways, it would be hard to find two people who are more different from each other than Donald Trump and Mitt Romney, right? And it's weird because they're both, you know, Republican politicians who are wealthy white men. So you would say, well, there are a lot of people who are very different. But everything about their value systems, their approaches to the world, what they consider important and what they consider not important, are very different. And I think that part of what kind of woke Mitt Romney up and compelled him to kind of rush towards this crisis was his personal kind of revulsion at Donald Trump's character.
Mm-hmm.
And this came up again and again in our conversations. Like, on one level, he actually kind of considered it an analytical failure on his part that he had such a hard time understanding why people liked Donald Trump. You know, he would tell me, I understand why people would vote for Donald Trump in a two-party system. You know, you're making trade-offs. And I understand that there are a lot of voters who feel left behind by the political class. And I get all that. And he's like, I just can't understand people who like the way Donald Trump is, you know, the vulgarity and the mistreatment of women and the kind of way that he almost dares people in this like subversive way to abandon him. And then the subversive thrill that supporters feel in not abandoning him. He just doesn't understand that on kind of a visceral level. But I do think that having him as a foil probably did make him more like it gave him a certain amount of like energy and vigor in this fight, because I think otherwise Mitt Romney probably wouldn't have gotten to the point where he was asking himself quite as many difficult questions about his own career and the far right elements of his party and where he had made compromises, because he didn't see kind of the worst manifestation of that kind of far right ethos that he had sometimes indulged. And to him, Donald Trump was the kind of worst case scenario manifestation of a toxic form of politics that had always existed in his party.
But it's funny because it seems like two things are true, that he both had that revulsion and an attraction to Trump. You write about how he found him very entertaining for some period of time.
He did. So he knew Trump, you know, all the way back in the 90s. He first met him. I write about his first kind of surreal visit to Mar-a-Lago. And it's not that, you know, I don't think he ever would have been like good buddies with Donald Trump, right? But for a long time in the 90s and the early 2000s, he would have these run-ins with Trump and kind of be like, oh man, what a crazy guy. You know, like his reaction to Trump was this guy is an outrageous celebrity, right? Like a loudmouth celebrity. So when you think of somebody that way, there's something almost kind of dehumanizing about it, right? Like, I don't think Romney was spending a lot of time thinking about Donald Trump's character or his morality. He just kind of saw him as like a TV character almost, that he would sometimes run into at, you know, Patriots games or at fundraisers or whatever. And they would have conversations where Trump would just say outrageous things. And Romney, you know, found him funny. He actually wrote in his journal. I found, you know, Romney handed over all his journals. And I found one entry buried in the 2012 journals where he talks about a phone call he had had with Trump. And he said, you know, they just don't make him like Donald Trump anymore. The guy is the real deal. No veneers, says whatever he thinks, you know. And when I read that to Romney, you can imagine he was like kind of chagrined by it. Right. But what he said was, you know, it kind of shows the seductive quality Donald Trump has as a personality, right? Like he has a lot of charisma. He has a larger than life persona. And when you're one-on-one with him, and if you're not thinking too hard about him as a person, and certainly not as a politician, you can be kind of seduced by it. What changed for Romney was once he started seeing Donald Trump as a serious political figure who was the leader of his party, that's where the revulsion really kicked in, because he had never in a million years thought of Donald Trump as somebody who would be qualified to run for office, let alone, you know, be in possession of the nuclear launch codes. And I think that kind of changed his personal visceral reaction to Trump and also his calculation in terms of how dangerous he was.
It makes me think about the two of them as like magnetic poles, that they're opposite, but there is that attraction. And maybe that's why Trump was such a good foil for him.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reeds. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much-neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit. Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, Should we be spending less on this with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities? Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
Mitt Romney expressed a lot of his disgust with people to you in the book, and he's such an aristocrat that some of the dishiness of the book really struck me. He has to know how petty it sounds. I wonder if that is venting or confession or some combination of those things, and how necessary is it to put those like ugly parts of yourself on the table when you're going through a process like this?
So it's funny because when the book came out, some of the first things to get attention were these like roundups, like the New York Times and Politico did these stories that were like Mitt Romney's burn book. And like, it was just like all the meanest things he had said about various prominent Republican politicians in my book. And I think a lot of the context was lost, obviously, in the way that coverage happened. You know, for one thing, some of these were things that he told me over the course of our 2 years of interviews. A lot of them were things that he had written in his journal, which, you know, going back 10 years or more, that I don't know he ever thought would be fully public, right? And he later kind of let it be known that when he gave me his journals, he had not taken the time to reread them. and there was a lot in there that I don't think he quite, you know, realized was in there. And Anne has kind of joked, like, if he had asked me, I might have said, maybe you reread them before you give them to a journalist. But I do think that that level of disclosure is probably necessary for a true reckoning. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time in therapy, but like, it does seem from what I've read about it, that, like, it is pretty important to be fully honest with yourself and about yourself, right? And I think that that's part of what was happening is his willingness to hand over all of his journals, hand over his emails. Like, he sent me hundreds and hundreds of emails with various politicians, some of which made him look good and some of which made him look less good. You know, like a lot of the stuff in his book and in his emails, you know, like it was a mixed bag in terms of how Mitt Romney came out looking. But I think it speaks to just like how ready he was to be vulnerable with me, that he was willing to kind of give all this stuff up. And you're right, like some of it makes him look petty. I think that the way I put it is that I think it reflects like how heartbroken he is by what his party has become, because a lot of the comments that he's made about these Republican leaders are in the context of like watching these people who he once had a lot of respect for, in his view, sell out their ideals and their principles to get reelected and to stay on the right side of Donald Trump. And for him, he's devoted his adult life to this party. And, you know, seeing that happen has just been really kind of devastating for him. And but so a lot of it is venting. But I do think you're right that like he was willing to show himself every side of himself, warts and all, in a way that ultimately, and I made this case to him and more to the people around him sometimes who were really nervous about how much he was giving me, you know, I think it creates a more human portrait of him. You know, I think that you come away reading this book feeling like you have a sense of this guy who is definitely not perfect. He's a flawed human, but it makes you kind of more endeared to him because he's willing to be so vulnerable. Whereas if he had held back those parts of himself, I think that he wouldn't have come off looking as real, but also I don't think he would have been able to really embark on this kind of reflection without it.
Well, McKay, I have spent a lot of time in therapy, and I feel like it's hard to be this vulnerable in that process. Like, I spent a lot of time trying to get an A+ in therapy. And as I read this book, I kept thinking, like, what an extraordinary container for reflection to be able to hand to someone all of your email, to be able to hand them your journals. I wonder, for those of us who are not going to have a biographer, you know, how we get that sort of container that you created for Mitt Romney for self-reflection.
Man, it's a great question. I have to say that I often found myself wondering, like, would I be willing to just give all of my emails and journals to anybody, you know, like, let alone a journalist who is going to publish them, but even just anyone? Like, I think that the human impulse to hide parts of yourself is incredibly strong. And I mean, probably healthy at some points, right? I don't think we need to reveal everything about ourselves to everyone. But like, you know, my wife has often joked while I was working on the book that I know Mitt Romney better than I know her at this point. And you know, she'd be like, I mean, look, you haven't read all my journals. You know, you don't know every inner thought that I've had, but you apparently do with Mitt Romney. I mean, I do think that, like, I'll just speak for myself. Like, part of the joy of working on this book was in how I was able to kind of turn the questions that I asked him on myself, right? Because one of the themes of the book is self-rationalization. And Mitt has talked to me a lot about moments in his career where he found himself rationalizing things that were in his self-interest and kind of convincing himself that these were the right things to do. And because I was thinking so much about it in the writing of this book and talking to him about it all the time, talking to the people in his inner circle and family about it, I inevitably ended up asking myself a lot about, like, when am I rationalizing things that are in my self-interest? When am I engaging in this kind of self-justification? And I can't claim to have, like, reached, you know, peak enlightenment there, but I do think just the kind of process and act of asking myself that question when I'm confronted with some kind of ethical dilemma or even just kind of making decisions about my life and career, like, I think acting like, am I actually doing what's right here, or am I just doing what's easy and convenient? I think that is better than nothing, right? At least that is, like, helping me kind of keep my conscience engaged, if that makes sense.
It does. And it feels so hard to me because I think so much of how we rationalize depends on our time frame. I wonder if Mitt Romney could have done this 10 years ago. His age seems to be a big component of it, his release of the idea that he's ever going to be the president. Also, his obsession with his own mortality. I was in a fatal car crash in high school.
Oh, wow.
And so when I read that he had that experience, I had to stick with those couple of pages for a few minutes and think about it. But that all feels essential to being able to do the true hard look at your career that he was trying to do here.
There's no question. I actually asked him at one point, you know, would you have been able to take this same, like, lonely, principled stand to vote to convict Trump in that first impeachment when he was the only Republican if you had been in this position 30 years ago? And he was honest with me, and he said, you know, I don't know if I can answer that. And he said, I think I recognize now my capacity for self-rationalization that I didn't recognize 30 years ago, right? And this question of, like, how, you know, how to look at the big picture when we're in, like, the grind of our daily lives is really hard. This is another thing that I wrestled with a lot, because Romney now is in the twilight of his career. He's in his mid-70s. He, like you said, is already predisposed to think about his death. And he's kind of been stalked by premonitions of death throughout his life, probably pegged to that early experience he had, that car crash. But because of that, he's able to kind of look at his life in longer term. And he thinks a lot about his legacy, and both his public legacy, but even more importantly, like, what his kids and grandkids and great grandkids are going to remember about him. Like, what are the stories that people are going to tell about him to them? Part of this also is religious for him. Like, his Mormon beliefs are really intertwined with this idea of, like, owing something to your ancestors and your progeny, right? Like, he believes that his family relationships are the most important things in his life, both in this life and eternally. And so because of that, like, he really does want them to remember him well. The trick, though, and this is, I think, what you were getting at, is that, like, it's really hard to think in those terms when you're in your 30s or 40s and you feel like you're, you know, you've still got so much life left to live and you're just trying to, you know, advance in your career or pay your mortgage or, you know, get through your day with the kids and spouse or whatever. And when he and I would talk about what are the lessons of his life and career, one of them was like the trick to getting our politicians to follow their conscience, to do what's right is, I think, getting them to think about their legacies and like what their obituaries are going to say when they're younger. You know, think more about what your obituary is going to say than what the next day's newspaper article is going to say. And that is much easier said than done. But I do think that's one of the secrets to incentivizing, you know, moral, ethical behavior in our political leaders.
And that makes me wonder, can a group go through this process? You know, you read the whole book and think the entirety of the Republican Party could use this moment, probably the Democratic Party too, probably a lot of community organizations and schools and churches. Do you think a group can do this, or is it necessarily an individual pursuit?
It's a good question. I don't know. It has to be fully individual. And in fact, in this case, it wasn't fully individual, right? He was having these conversations with his wife and with his kids and then with me, right? So in part, I actually do think he needed the process of an interlocutor, you know, somebody who came over to his house once a week. And, you know, I don't think he is in therapy, but like in a way, our 2 years of interviews were therapeutic and cathartic in nature. But, you know, he had a person who came to his house to ask him these difficult questions. And, you know, maybe that can be replicated at the community level, you know, all of us kind of asking ourselves difficult questions. But, you know, part of the trick, and this is just my approach as a journalist, I think other journalists have different approaches, but like, I try when I am sitting down with this subject to not be hyper adversarial right off the bat, right? Like, you need to create a rapport and some amount of trust to get anything approaching like honesty or candor, especially from a political leader. But I think this is true of anyone. And so, you know, I tried to show that I was, you know, really listening to him. And so I think that there are lessons there that could be replicated at community levels in churches or schools or, you know, at the political level. The key is that nobody ever feels like they're being listened to, especially at this political moment, right? No one feels heard. And, you know, Amanda Ripley is a journalist who wrote a book called High Conflict about how to engage in healthy conflict. And she talks about how one of the keys to having any kind of productive conflict or conversations about difficult issues is that we have to show to each other that we're hearing what they're saying. And that involves, you know, repeating back what they're saying in our own language to kind of prove that we're listening to them. I think that there's a lot of wisdom in that, and not nearly enough of it is happening in our politics right now.
I'm glad that you mentioned your process as a biographer. We always end with something on our minds outside of politics. And I wanted to know what forces have really shaped you as a writer. There were several sentences in this book that just kind of took my breath away. I thought I wish I could write a sentence that well. So tell me how you have developed your craft.
And that's very nice of you to say. How have I developed my craft? I mean, I am one of these like weird kids who knew I wanted to be a writer from the time I was like 11 years old. And I would write little short stories and try to sell them to my parents for like 25 cents. I produced a family newspaper with my siblings. So I've always been interested in writing and reading. But like, you know, when people ask me about like, what is the secret to like learning how to write? Like, first of all, I always answer that I will let you know when I learn how to write. I feel like I'm incredibly hard on myself at like most writers that I know. But I think the answer is like, you just have to do it a lot. You have to write a lot and read a lot. And that, you know, I think in terms of what's shaped my perspective as a writer, I think a lot of, you know, being growing up in Massachusetts as a Mormon kid, you know, like made me kind of an outsider in some ways that I think have actually been really useful as a journalist. I think that I've had a lot of life experiences that have taught me how to be a good listener and observe little details about human interactions that have shown up in my pieces. But in terms of just the craft of writing, like, there really is no shortcut beyond practicing all the time and then reading the best writers that you can.
It is this really interesting mix. Going back to our specific flavor of arrogance, I feel like being a good writer has to be this combination of really believing that you have something to say or a way of saying it that people can hear, while also being willing to get out of the way. I don't know. I feel like that's a lifetime of practice trying to develop the balance of those two things.
Well, and I would also say, like, I know I've gotten to know a lot of writers, obviously, in my career, and we all have our own kind of coping mechanisms for how to feel like we can finally show something that we're writing to another person, because writing inherently is, like, incredibly solitary and incredibly vulnerable, you know, regardless of whether you're writing about yourself or your own life or not, like, it showing something that you've written to somebody else is just, like, an act of enormous vulnerability. And the way that I end up doing it when my editor is demanding that I show her a draft of, you know, a feature that I've been writing or an essay or something, is that I literally take, like, half an hour before I send it to her to type out all of my, like, caveats and apologies for where I'll say, like, okay, I'm sending this to you, but I know the beginning of it is a mess, and I know the middle part needs this and this and this, and I'm not sure if this theme is really coming through. And I literally will, like, write out all of my insecurities about the piece. And because I have a good relationship with this editor, like, I trust her to not, like, you know, use it against me or to, like, laugh at me, although she does sometimes laugh at me. I also know writers who go the opposite way, where they have to, like, perform this huge amount of confidence when they turn a piece in that I don't know if they really feel or not, but they'll be like, I feel great about this one. Here you go. And I personally can't relate to that at all, but I think it's their way of, like, convincing themselves to just turn something in, you know? But we all kind of have ways to, like, grapple with the vulnerabilities and insecurities of writing, because I do think it's, like, you know, I try not to be too precious about this, because writing ultimately is, like, if you look at the entire, like, menu of potential jobs you could have as a human, like, writing is a pretty privileged one, you know? I'm not, you know, digging holes for a living, but, like, it takes a lot of vulnerability to write things for other people to read. And so we all have our own ways of kind of dealing with that, I think.
I think that sense of listing all the insecurities and caveats is why the universe gifted me with a podcast, and why podcasting is, like, memeable as an exercise in confidence, because you just have to do it.
Yep.
And doing it with someone else means that you are releasing control over what the final product is going to be. And so we just constantly tell ourselves, well, you know what? We're going to make another one. There will always be another one.
This is maybe why podcasters are, like, inherently just more mentally healthy than writers. That's going to be that's my working premise. That's a very emotionally healthy approach to creating content for the world.
I attribute it completely to my partner. That's another thing. I'm glad I don't have a solo pursuit. Well, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for the book and for spending time with me.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo, and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine. Instead of just slathering more products on my face, it feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never frozen meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15. Thank you so much to McKay for this conversation that I'll be thinking about for a long time. And I want to share a bit of another conversation I keep returning to before we go. We host a book club for our premium members, and this fall we included Jane Ferguson's No Ordinary Assignment. Jane is an award-winning foreign correspondent for PBS NewsHour, contributor to The New Yorker, and McGraw Professor of Journalism at Princeton University. I had the pleasure of speaking with Jane about her book in a conversation that I found moving and insightful and delightful, and we wanted to share a few minutes of it with all of you. Well, we're talking to a group of people, many of whom will have read the book by the time they hear this conversation. And I know that they're going to have lots of questions about your writing process. So I wanted to start there if we could. As I was reading the book, I have two daughters. They both were very interested in what I was reading because you have such an arresting cover. And my older daughter, Jane, has been talking to me about what's in the book and what should she understand about it. And I said, this is one that I would really love for you to read. And it made me wonder, as I'm telling my seventh grader, you should read this book, who you wrote this book for? Who was the audience that you had in mind as you were working on the book?
Thank you for asking that question, because I love that question. You know, I wrote the book for anybody, really. You know, I very much so didn't want to write just for foreign correspondents to read. You know, as journalists read each other's books. I wanted predominantly, though, to really write this book for young people. I was increasingly concerned by how much, like the more successful I was becoming professionally, the more I was doing these events where I would talk to young people, young journalists or students, and I could see them looking at me and starting to ask questions that told me they thought I had all of it figured out, that I had had this incredibly successful, straight trajectory, upward ascent in my career. And it mattered to me to tell those young people that that was absolutely not the case, that I have failed, I have fallen on my face, I have massively doubted myself, I've struggled, and that's normal and that's totally fine. And it mattered to me that young people didn't let things stop them. You know, there were so many moments in my career where I could have just given up. And I wanted young people to see what it really is like, warts and all, so they wouldn't feel as though they were failing, or, you know, no matter what career they're in, something competitive, something highly ambitious, something people tell you not to bother even trying with. I wanted them to see what the real underbelly of actually making your dreams come true looks like, so that they wouldn't give up.
And in your case, what that looks like took so much resourcefulness. You know, I was doing the math, so I'm a few years older than you. I think about the time that you were learning Arabic in Yemen, I was starting my career in a law firm. And I was so frustrated as a new lawyer at the fact that I was showing up every day waiting for someone to give me work to do, because I thought, you're paying me, I would like to work. And I didn't really understand how long it takes to build a pipeline of work. And I felt so bratty reading your book and thinking about the fact that you're out there doing the work and saying, will someone please pay me for this incredibly valuable, risky, dangerous thing I'm attempting to give you? So tell me about where you think you got that inner resolve. Like, I am just going to do the work and trust that it will pay off at some point.
You know, I think a big part of it was the fact that I didn't really want to do anything else. You know, I had this calling since I was a little girl. This is kind of all that I wanted to do. And the reality is I didn't really have a plan B. I decided I'd rather be broke doing what I love and, you know, struggling and trying to do that than give up. And on top of that, I also just had to have a blind faith that it would somehow work out. I look back at that young girl now and I smile at her optimism, you know? I mean, it's great that I was so naive, because if I'd been more wily and worldly, I probably might have quit, you know? So I think that I had to believe it was going to work out for me. Also, there are career struggles, but in between all of those career, you know, fears, trying to make ends meet, trying to pay the bills, struggling and failing to pay the bills, there are also these moments where you recognize that you absolutely love the work. You know, I mean, I had such incredible moments on the road. I felt so connected to the storytelling and to the people that really buoyed me and kept me moving forward. You know, I had to believe that something I loved so much and that I was slowly figuring out how to do well would eventually work out for me.
You can hear my full discussion with Jane on our premium show, More to Say, and you can use the information in our show notes to learn more about our premium community, where the first book boxes for our 2024 book club reads will go on sale next week. We partner with Lisa, a listener, and her independent bookstore for these boxes, which make fantastic gifts for you or others. Jane Ferguson and McKay Coppins in one episode is like a dream for me. Thanks to both of them and to all of you for supporting our work. We'll be back with you on Tuesday for a new episode. Until then, have the best weekend available to you.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production.
Elise Knapp is our managing director. Maggie Pinton is our director of community engagement.
Xander Singh is the composer of our theme music with inspiration from original work by Dante Lima.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers,
Martha Brunitsky,
Allie Edwards,
Janice Elliott,
Sarah Greenup,
Julie Haller,
Tiffany Hassler,
Emily Holiday,
Katie Johnson,
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling,
Barry Kaufman,
Molly Kors,
Catherine Vollmer,
Lori Ladau,
Lily McClure,
Linda Daniel,
Emily Neasley,
The Pattons,
Tracy Putoff,
Sarah Ralph,
Jeremy Sequoia,
Katie Steigers,
Karen True,
Annika Uvaline,
Nick and Elisa Vallelli,
Amy Whited,
Emily Helen Olson,
Lee Shea McDonough,
Morgan McHugh,
Jen Ross,
Sabrina Drigo,
Becca Dorval,
Christina Quarteraro,
Shannon Frawley.
The Adair family.
Jeff Davis, Melinda Johnston, Michelle Wood, Nicole Berkles, Paula Bremer, and Tim Miller.